But these are kids, well, these are things that I just tell you everything.
All right, well, let's start out here. Okay. I'm Autumn Wheeler, and I am interviewing Lowell Bullis on April 2nd, 2005 for an oral history project for MSUB. I'm going to ask you some just general questions first about your life before the war, and then we'll get into some specifics when you were in the war, and then some feelings about being in the war and your life after the war. So, you grew up in Hardin?
Yes, I was born and raised in Hardin.
Okay.
You want my birth date?
That would be fabulous.
Well, it's September 16th, 1924.
My birthday is September 8th, 1975, so we're both Virgos. What was your life like before the war? What did your family do for a living?
Don't get scared.
Mortuary.
My father was the undertaker.
Yes.
He had established the Bullis Mortuary there. In 1913,
okay,
when he first went to Hardin. And I lived there all my life, went to grade school, high school, and was drafted about 60 days before graduation time.
So were you 18 then?
I was 18 and a half.
18 and a half.
And as a result, I officially did not graduate. However, I did get my diploma and the like.
Oh, good.
And in the letter I brought over here
today. The first letter that you wrote.
That's the first letter that I wrote from Camp Edwards in Cape Cod, close to Hyannis, Massachusetts.
Okay. So you were in high school when you got drafted, so you weren't married then?
No.
You weren't, okay. While you were in school, what were your political leanings towards the war?
You know,
had any feelings towards the war?
The word political never existed.
See, that's what I've been hearing. Never existed until I think about the 1970s or something.
It wasn't whether we got into it or why we got into the war, but it was the fact that when would I go? And I was one that was drafted out of school. There were some others that had really done this, had been done too. If you were 18 and a half, in about March or so of 43, you got automatically drafted. And we went up to Butte. Well, we had a sort of little preliminary physical, make sure we had no wooden legs and so forth.
Right, right.
There in Hardin with Dr. Labatt. And he said we were then fine, and we went up to Butte, and they gave us a physical and determined that we're okay. One thing happened during that physical at the Butte. I don't worry about this, so you can tell anybody.
Okay. Else.
But he was examining, his doctor was examining my teeth. And he told me, son, you got teeth good enough for a major. I said, a major with buck teeth? And, see, I only got about 3/4 of an inch overbite. Whether you noticed it, I always keep my mouth ajar so most people don't even know it. And he looked at me and looked at my teeth and looked at me. He went and got another doctor, brought him over. And this other guy looked at my teeth and he looked at me and he said, son, I don't know how you eat, but you don't look undernourished. It's a true story.
You've already gone over how your perceptions of the military were. It wasn't a question of when you were or where you were going, it was just when you got in. What were your opinions regarding Germany and Japan before the war? What were your feelings before? Did you know anything about them?
Well, of course, before we got into the war, Germany was taking over most of Europe, all but France, you might mm-hmm. say, and Holland. Italy threw in with them and the like. So Hitler politically took over Austria and Romania and all of the Poland and so forth, and without really doing a lot of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then he took on France, and the British went over, and of course the British got beat, and they went to a little port by the name of Dunkirk, and they fought off the Germans. They lost a lot of men, and they used every boat that was floating, from a rowboat on up, to take all of their men, and they left all the equipment behind. And then that threw us, Roosevelt put us into World War II. We weren't in the war at that time with
right.
them, but we were giving England so-called land lease, mm-hmm. giving them stuff.
So did you study the current events in high school before the war? Did you discuss them?
We had current events, but they were sort of a matter of fact, because we weren't running out in the streets and
right.
Yelling about this and that and that's the other thing. But it wasn't until the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And we all knew that it was just a matter of fact when we were going.
Mm-hmm.
I was a junior in high school at that time, and that put us into World War II actively, and we built up England and alike tremendously.
So what was the community's response? You've expressed your response of Pearl Harbor, but what was the community in Hardin? How did everybody feel when they found out about Pearl Harbor?
Well, just about like I said, it wasn't, nobody rushed out in the streets and yelled, and the KGHL radio here in Billings was the only radio station at the time, and of course we got the news over that, and we would get other, Des Moines, Iowa, we could get other stations around, from Minneapolis, Des Moines, Iowa, WHO, and Denver, KOA Denver, and that's about all we got. And but it was just a mere matter of, well, we're in it.
Yeah.
That's all. It was nothing politically like it is today.
Right.
I mean, something happens in Washington, D.C., and, excuse the expression, all the college students run out and protest against it.
They protest and they don't know what they're protesting against.
That's right. They do not know what they're protesting against. And we knew. One thing that I haven't said, what I always like to put in a disclaimer.
Okay. Go right ahead.
So many of the, during World War II, or one, excuse me, so many of the veterans, when I was back about 9 years old, they were telling stories what they did in World War I. And then those stories proved to be false.
Really?
And I always told myself, if I was ever in a war, I would tell people exactly what I did. So I made this story up, and I got scared. So Spent 20 months in a dark room. When they wanted to send me closer to the enemy, they sent the wax in. When they made it safe, then they called me.
Okay.
And as funny as it might sound, that is true.
Doesn't sound funny to me at all.
I was trained to run a 36 and 50 foot landing boat. We were an amphibious engineer.
Mm-hmm.
First Training Battalion, 4th Engineers Special Brigade. And we were taught to run the landing boats, shoot 30 and 50 caliber machine guns, and we did that before I was 19.
Wow.
And when we left Camp Edwards, they put us on a troop train, and I don't know why, but they took us up into Canada and down through Detroit. And how I can remember so well is we stopped at Hershey, Pennsylvania. And I was the so-called guard then, and the engineer and I stepped out, and over in the background was Hershey Candy Bar Factory.
Oh, it's a good thing to remember.
And you could smell the sort of stale milk, sour milk odor in there. And that was September 16th, 1940.
Your birthday!
My birthday. So that's when I turned 19 years old.
Heck of a 19th birthday for you.
So, and we later went to Camp Stoneman by Pittsburgh, California, and we spent some time before they got us on the ship.
Okay. Just to back up, minute or two. Before the war, while you were still in high school, what were your daily concerns being 18, 17 years old?
Going to school on time and doing everything else.
Yeah. I mean, did you help your father with his business?
When I was about 16 years old, this actually happened. I went to bed about 9 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
And around 9:30, Dad said, "Well, I need some help. A sheepherder had died out almost the bio boundary, on the west boundary of the Kearney Reservation, out by Pryor."
Mm-hmm.
So I got up, got dressed. We went down, we got the pickup, and then we went out to Pryor, and we got the sheepherder in the basket to the usual days, and we put that in the pickup. Dad drove the sheepherder's car ahead of me in case it stopped. I mean, I could pull him in at least.
Yeah.
So I drove from there on back to Hardin, and we got in Hardin. We got the man on the mark table, and I walked home, and it was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and I laid down, and my mother got me up at 8:30. I got dressed and cleaned up and ate breakfast. We lived 2 blocks from the school. Walked and ran to the school, was there on time. Not one teacher knew that I was out all night long.
Really?
Without any sleep. And it may sound odd, but I consider that as being one of the best training things that
Absolutely.
Ever happened to me, because in the Army, they'd put us on guard duty, and we'd had to get up at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, whatever it was, mm-hmm. in the morning. And a lot of the fellows weren't used to that, and they were literally walking their route asleep. And I was as wide awake as ever.
Well,
and so I never considered that as being any punishment or
no.
anything else. It was just
certainly helped in your basic training.
Just, well, yeah, but and that was something that we did, all of us over the years have done to help my father out one time or the other.
It's So your family seems very family-oriented.
By the way, Edward, Dad was an undertaker. Edwin, the oldest brother, he worked at it for a few years. And they have a brother, and Everett worked at that for about 53. In fact, he still does the work. So there's three of them. I worked with them for 3.5 years, but I never got my embalming license or anything. But I would say, by trade, I was a photographer, and I closed my studio in Laurel to go down and help them, and then in 54, I got married and opened up the photographic studio again.
Okay. You said you were drafted into the war. We established that. And we already talked about how you felt about being drafted. Did you have any expectations about being drafted? About what being in basic training would be like?
No. We all figured there's a close quarter drill and learning how to shoot a rifle and so forth. I was always active in Boy Scouts, so when it comes to camping out, it comes to hiking, learning any knots, so forth, I was there. In fact, they asked us while we were starting our training, how many of us are talking about first aid? And they wonder how many of us knew anything about artificial respiration.
Right.
Well, in Boy Scouts, we learned that. And I was the only one out of about maybe 100 or more that had any idea of artificial respiration. That changed a lot today against
right.
what it is. But that was it. And then we got to a point on the ship, they wanted to use semaphore signaling, using flags and yarns in different positions. And one of the things I did on my first class badge was to learn semaphore, send and receive. And one thing I never did get my first class badge, because I still don't, to this day, know how to swim.
Really?
But that's why they put me in the amphibious engineers. But
so you don't know how to swim?
No.
No?
I've been clear across the Pacific and
that is extremely ironic and almost very humorous. Okay. Where did your basic training take place at?
In Camp Edwards, Massachusetts.
Okay.
We did close quarter drill, hikes, and like. And it may seem odd to say this, but it was actually true. Our final hike was 50 miles in one day. And we were about 2-3 miles away from camp, and they put me out. I was at the head of the column, so I stood in the middle of the road, so in any case, I truck or something came along, and they wouldn't run over any of the platoons behind us. And after when the next one came up, he took his place, and I went up. I thought, well, I'll catch up with the guys. So I started running, and I'm not a runner. And I caught up to the end of the column. The change of pace was so relaxing to me. I ran right up to the front door of the class.
Really?
At the beginning. And those kids, the rest of the guys were just shaking their heads. This stupid guy, why are you running? Aren't you tired? But it was the change of pace. So really
right.
It was made it relaxing.
Let's see. Was your family and friends supportive of you?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, there in the same draft I was in, there was about 20 of us from Bighorn County, and there was a number from back there that has a picture of Bill, of Irwin Stinsgood here, Bill Threans, Joe Knows the Ground, Kelvin Jefferson, Little Son, Little Boy, Frank Bear Quiver, all Indian boys.
Mm-hmm.
About half of them were Indian. There's the one fellow who was, his name was Bad Horse, and the like. And, but it, people were very supportive of us. And they, when I was up the Butte, they're handing out our papers. I missed this earlier. And that is, I figured, well, I've never been called Charles. It always was my middle name of Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I better listen for it. And so sure enough, Charles Bullis, the guy called. I went up, I got my papers, went back in the back room, sat down by Bill Threans. And they were handing out papers, and all of a sudden, Bill poked me in the ribs. Hey, Lowell, they want you up there. And I went up, and the guy said, where have you been? I said, sit there back there. And he said, don't you know your own name? I said, not when you call me Charles. But they made me acting corporal, and I was the one responsible, let's say, for taking the 20-25 guys there. We didn't get on an airplane, we didn't get on a bus, we got on a train.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Butte and changed trains on Union Pacific, and then went down to Salt Lake City. And we came out there, I handed the guy my papers, and he didn't hardly then say thank you or nothing, and we were off, got in trucks, went to Fort Lewis, Washington, down in Salt Lake. And we got our uniforms and like, and within about a week and a half, we were on a train and we didn't know where. Then we went to Camp Edwards, Massachusetts.
How was military life different from your civilian life?
I guess we looked at those days, we looked at it differently. We knew we got, say, yes sir, no sir, I don't know sir, and salute and get your pay. But the thing is, that was the military. And then we accepted it for what it was. And those that didn't soon found out that they had to fall in line and do things correctly. I would say out of all, I forget on the pictures, it must be 250
right.
or so people in my that company picture. And what we were out was machine gun training on Papanesid Beach. And one of the fellas there, I never knew what it was, but he did something and he was going to get it his way. So he did. They handed him a shovel, walked over to a spot and said, you dig a hole 6 feet square, 6 feet deep. At the end of the day, when he got it done, they threw a cigarette butt in and filled it up.
Oh my.
He never questioned anything and what his authority after that. And but it's we took it, our attitude is we're here, now let's learn how to do this stuff. And we when we took the machine gun training on Papanesid Beach, we learned how to take the Browning Mark 4 50 and 30 caliber machine guns apart.
Okay.
And put them back together again, blindfolded.
Mm.
And we put our helmets over our face so we couldn't see. Well, the photography, I spent more time with my dark room than most of them did in the swimming pool. But the thing is, I was so used to doing things in the dark, in the total darkness and stuff like that. But that was the easiest thing in the world for me to do.
You seem very, from your life experience, you seem very well trained for the military. What thing did you like the most about basic training?
Oh, I don't know. I guess just plain learning what the things we had to learn.
Okay.
And we had a rifle to fire. I'd never fired a 30 caliber rifle. I fired the shotguns and were 22s, but nothing of that size. And we were trained with the M1 rifle. It weighed 9 pounds, and we, that 9 pounds at the end of our training was no effort for us to do anything, carry it, or it just was a third arm to us. We were so accustomed to carrying it, so accustomed to handling it, and alike.
Okay, let's see here. So I'm going to get into some photography stuff, considering I'm a photographer also. How did you feel about photography before you went into the service?
I actually was trying to find somebody where I could get into a photographic unit. And every time I spoke to anyone, we can't interrupt your training. There's no way you can get out of here, and the like. And when we went overseas, by the way, the ship we went overseas on, we were really on a fast ship. Top speed, 13 knots. It's about 15 miles an hour, had triple expansion steam engines from the English. The ship was owned by the Germans, captured by the Americans during World War II, and we rode on that same ship.
Wow.
And one of our motors went out, and so we traveled one whole day or 2 days on, with about the, maybe 6 or 8 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. With one motor and a line. When we got to Australia, I had one thing wrong with me. My tonsils were bothering me. I used to dry Montana weather. I got off on the East Coast, and my tonsils bothered me, and they wouldn't do anything. And they said, "We can't interrupt your training." I got on the ship, and about the third day out, I can hardly talk. I went on sick call, and they painted my throat with some stuff. And about the fourth day I was in there, the doctor said, "Well, when you get to Australia, tell them that we said to have your tonsils out." So when we got there, we landed in Sydney, and went to they used the racetracks, which were operating there because they had areas they could put tents up and water and everything for the soldiers. And we went out to Warwick Farms, about 25 miles south of Sydney. And that may seem odd, but we're that far south. And it was cold. In fact,
really?
there was a fog. That day it was foggy, and the fog was about 2 feet up off the air, and that damp and the like. Well, about 3 or 4 days, and then they put us on a train, and we traveled to Brisbane by train. That's like going from, say, San Francisco to Seattle.
Oh, wow.
By train. And we went to what they call Ascot Racetrack there in Brisbane, which was the sixth replacement depot. And they were monkeying around and so forth, and weren't doing much. And finally, after about the fourth day there, I went to sick call, and So as they sent me down to Southport, about 50 miles south of Brisbane, and hospital there, and they took my tonsils out. And one of the photographs I have, the big long one,
mm-hmm.
that's they sent me on a 7-day convalescent furlough.
Oh, wow.
And in the ambulance that took me to Coolangatta, the guy, the driver, had gotten some turkey. That was Thanksgiving Day.
Wow.
And again, and that was in 43. And I ate some turkey and I could hardly swallow mm-hmm. it because my tonsil and my throat was sore. Well, by the end of the time, I went back, and they went back to Ascot Raceway track again, the replacement depot. And all the rest of the guys had left. And I found out that where they were, they're over at Camp Baruka on the other side of Brisbane. And I didn't have anything to do. I got a pass. I go over to Camp Baruka and say hello to everybody.
So, yeah. You know,
and I'm like, well, finally, I figured, well, I'm just sitting here. So I went up to the office in the area, and I asked them if I could get into a photographic unit. And this major, he got my records out, and he looked, oh, said, we already have you on. You're to go to Ship and Gun Crew over there at Camp Baruka. Ship and Gun Crew. I said, yes, that's over at Camp Baruka. He was amazed that I knew all about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's for the rest of mine. So we went down there. But we trained on Springfield's on 20mm Swiss Mark IV machine gun. They only fired 120 rounds a minute.
Mm-hmm.
20 millimeters, about 3/4 of an inch
okay.
bore. And we did some work with a 40 millimeter Bolter and a 75 millimeter Gannon and the like. Well, after we got sort of done, we were sort of sitting around, and so happened that in the same camp in Maruka, down the ways, was a 32nd Signal Corps. So I wasn't doing anything one day, and I walked down there and asked them if they had a photographic unit. They said, yes, we do. There's one over by Luna Park. Well, I finally found out where Luna Park was, and it was an old dance hall. And they had
to
up a real high hill to go up to get to it. And it wasn't there. It was right in the house place next door to it called Centra House.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally got over there and I walked in and I saw Captain Stevens and I told him that I'd like to join the photographic unit. And he said, do you ever do any work? I said, yes. I taught myself photography
really?
From 13 to 18 years of age. And he asked me some questions, what's in the D-72 developer, and I told
right.
him, and I can tell you monomethyl amylphenyl sulfate, and you're going to say, huh?
Huh?
Well, it goes by the trade name of Metol or Eon, Rhodol,
mm-hmm.
Pictol, all kinds of names, depending on the manufacturer.
All I know is by R.A.
But at any rate, we, he saw it that I understood photography, and he said, yeah, we'll take you. So I gave him all the information,
and just
he filled
units?
It out, and I sent it over to the Ship and Gun Crew guys, and about a week later, I transferred over, and I was in the 82nd Signal Corps, Photographic Detachment.
Very cool. This is one of my favorite pictures of the dark room. Where is this located at?
All right, this is in the Central House. I'll just turn it upside down.
Mm-hmm.
I can read
okay.
upside down. But this is Jose Nanaka and Donald Lee, and I don't know what the other guy's name is. But he, this is where all of the film in those days was black and white.
Right.
And it was a 4 by 5 inch negative.
Mm-hmm.
with one exception. Ira Rosenberg, he carried a 4x5 speed graphic around for years, and he said, I'm not carrying that thing anymore. He rode home, got a Super Icona B camera.
They want to talk to us. Press.
You want to stop there?
Yep.
But I said right here, there are three, these are what's called a Peco Junior printer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that machine running?
It is running.
Okay. And we would print as many as 200 negatives a day, 13 copies of each.
Really?
And we process them in the tray on this side and this side, and this was our stop, the acetic
mm-hmm.
acid tray
mm-hmm.
to stop the action of the developer.
Right.
And this was the fixing bath, and F1 hypo bath, they call it. And, but we had to print 13 copies. I was there. I actually worked here for 20 months in the darkroom.
And what were some of the pictures that you took of?
Well,
were they recreational?
Well,
were they?
No. These others here, the ship with the rockets on it.
This one?
That's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
This is during the Hollandia landing. Shortly after they finished up there in New Guinea. It lies the north to east to southwest, and on the southwest end was a couple towns, Ley and Fishhaven. And around the middle was what's called Owen Stanley Mountains.
Okay.
And the Japanese stayed on the north side of it. They never really went over. They dead bomb Fort Moresby on the south side a time or two, but nothing special. But after they cleaned up then MacArthur got enough ships and their men and so forth, and they made three landings, which was at Wewak, Hollandia, and Atipi. And Wewak was in the Australian portion of New Guinea, and Hollandia was just over the border, maybe 5 or 10 miles, and then Atipi was on up a little way.
So your photographs were to document the war for the Army?
Yeah, it's all for the on the Army. But this particular ship, we got one of the things that we got to see, we saw a lot of these, but this was an LST.
Okay, yeah.
The landing ship transport. Now, they had a ramp of shearway on each side here.
Okay.
And these were 3-inch rockets. And this was one of the first rockets that they were using for, and they had like a 55-gallon barrel.
Okay.
And on each side, they had racks about 18 inches wide, about 4 feet square, on one on each side. And that fellow would sit in the middle. Well, they had these lined up here, maybe 100 or more. And they were fired electrically, and they push a button, and
mm-hmm.
these rockets would take off. On all of these, they probably had 50 or 100 different launches. And they got out at a certain distance from the shore. And then as they fired, they would go inshore right slowly, and so that they actually, they kept, and they would chase away every soldiers, the Japanese, away from the beach and
okay.
the like, so it would make it safe for our guys to go in. They strafed them with aircraft, and at that time, the B-25 bomber, a light bomber, had two motor. They had put 50 caliber machine guns, and they had about 20 or more on the outside, under the wings, in the nose, plus a 75-millimeter gun that was a reduced charge for the aircraft. And they strafed back, chased the Japanese away from the beach, and went on.
Mm-hmm.
There's one thing that I don't have pictures of it here, but I printed them, so I know it.
Mm-hmm.
But on Atipi, I believe it was a tape. Either tape or Weavac, one of the two. The Japanese, when they went into Hong Kong years before, they took 5-inch British naval guns that were guarding the port there. They took them and brought them over there to New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two or three of them, and they had stacks of ammunition shelled there. And when our guys went in, they chased the Japanese back. They saw all these guns and all the ammunition. They're on a naval mount, which moved in a full circle.
Okay.
They turned them around, they loaded them up, and they were firing heavy artillery at the Japanese with their own the guns.
And you caught all this with your camera.
So it may sound odd, but I printed those pictures and all that.
I think these guys want to talk to us.
Finally, but did you know that in 1948, a shipload of ammonia fertilizer blew up in Texas City? I was talking with the fellow, the guy named Harrenberg, who worked in radio photo, and he maintained the machinery and sent the pictures. But he's now working for United Press or some of those that had these wire photo machine there, and I was talking to him in the Tribune Tower there, in the Tribune, Public Tribune building, and I saw the Texas City disaster pictures that they were being dried before they were able to print it in the Chicago Tribune. And they sent those things that you got by wire photo that was on a drum that used a checkerboard stripe on one side, and the person sending it had to be in contact with the one receiving it, so they start at the same time. Otherwise, they get just half the picture. Mm-hmm. And it moved a hundredth of an inch, a light would shine on the print and reflect back to a photocell, and change it into an electrical signal that turns it to a radio signal that was transmitted, and then the other end took the radio signal and made it back into electrical, and a light 1/100 of an inch square would flash on and on, exposing the film, and creating the picture.
And now we just send them over the internet. Just clicking the mouse button.
You're scanning these things. It got hundreds of lines, and doing that every 60 of them, 100, 25 or 30, whatever it is,
a minute. A lot different. We're kind of running out of batteries, so can I do a short interview with you first?
You bet.
We came here with